I'm Jonathan Bastian. This week on KCRW's Life Examined, when it comes to negative personality traits, perhaps none is more overused than being narcissistic. Narcissists, it seems, are everywhere, from our partners, parents, and politicians to the CEOs in Silicon Valley.
CEOs of corporations are more likely to be narcissistic than the population at large by about 6%. So we see a higher prevalence of narcissism among CEOs overall, Silicon Valley and everywhere.
And later, understanding what narcissism means and how it presents itself in others.
These are also people who are very, very, very sensitive to any form of feedback, criticism. It might not even be that it's negative feedback, but because they're so grandiose, your simple piece of feedback can spin them out into a rage. However, while they can't take it, they can dish it out.
Narcissism, from the boardroom to the bedroom, and what to look for and how to steer clear. That's coming up on KCRW's Life Examined. It's been called a narcissism epidemic, the selfie generation, a culture that prizes self-aggrandizement and self-promotion. And the problem isn't just with social media. We're being raised in an era of self-belief and validation. Our idols are pioneers, artists, and CEOs, the Steve Jobs and Elon Musks of the world, titans who, despite their critics, took a wrecking ball to the status quo. And while vision and grit play an important role, do you also need a level of narcissism to be highly successful? And what does it say about us when those we admire and are most attracted to often exhibit dark and harmful narcissistic traits? Jennifer Chapman has looked closely into these questions. She's professor of management at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, also the co-director of the Berkeley Center for Workplace Culture and Innovation and associate dean for academic affairs. Jennifer Chapman, welcome to Life Examined. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
If you could give your own just very short definition of how you understand narcissistic behavior, how would you describe it?
Well, there are psychological definitions of the syndrome, and it really has to do with a kind of self-focus and a prioritization of one's own objectives as kind of supreme and really much more important than considering collective objectives or any other individual's objectives. So you see a kind of self-absorption, but there are also some interesting interpersonal attributes like a kind of grandiosity, and narcissistic people are often quite charismatic. They have bold visions. They believe so much in themselves that they think they can do lots of different things. And they feel confident that they can lead and inspire others. So narcissism is often confused with visionary leadership, ironically.
Right. Talk about how you see this show up where you are. I mean, you're near Silicon Valley. This is where we think of these iconic leaders with big ideas that are, you know, trying to steer the ship in interesting and different directions. Where do you see it show up?
Well, what we know is that CEOs of corporations are more likely to be narcissistic than the population at large by about 6%. So we see a higher prevalence of narcissism among CEOs overall, Silicon Valley and everywhere. And, you know, that partly has to do with the kind of, again, the confidence that people need to have to believe that they can lead an organization or an initiative or a new idea or be an innovator, and to sort of push it through. Note that it is not a necessary ingredient to success in any of those domains, right? You could be a visionary without being narcissistic. In fact, over the longer run, it's much more effective to actually think about the collective good and to be genuinely interested in inspiring people to step up. But we do see it among Silicon Valley leaders. I am hesitant to name names, but, you know, there are some obvious contenders that seem fairly self-absorbed and ultimately more interested in promoting their own ideas, their own wealth. They think about others as kind of a means to their end. So they're willing to, you know, borderline exploit people to ensure that they come along with their vision. And one of the most telltale signs of a narcissistic leader is a kind of lack of people that they've developed. They don't have a stable of people who've gone on to be leaders themselves.
So you said you don't want to name names here, but I mean, we think of people obvious, like Elon Musk, maybe, or others, maybe Steve Jobs, Sam Bankman-Fried. I mean, Elizabeth Holmes, would you be able to say any of them seem to fit this personality type?
Yeah, well, I will say that I don't think Sam Bankman-Fried fits the type. I actually have had long conversations with Michael Lewis, the author of the book about Sam Bankman-Fried. And I asked him this exact question. I think Bankman-Fried was righteous and believed in a vision, but he also believed in altruism. He believed that what he was doing would be good for the world ultimately, and that was his goal. And he wasn't, in fact, interested in, you know, wealth and power. He kind of shied away from those things. So I think he's something else. You know, Elizabeth Holmes, hard to know. There may be some sociopathy there, and often narcissism and sociopathy go together. Sometimes Machiavellianism goes together. They're called together the dark triad. You know, Elon Musk, people have certainly used the term narcissistic in the same sentence as his name. And, you know, I think we could point to a number of behaviors and attributes that look that way. I think what I would want to caution people to realize is that there are all kinds of incredibly successful leaders and entrepreneurs who are not narcissistic. And so we don't want to, it's what statisticians call sampling on the dependent variable. We don't just want to pick out the successful leaders who are narcissistic and then decide that narcissism is an essential quality for leadership success or entrepreneurial success.
But talk about the fact that, you know, these are, in the world of Silicon Valley, there's almost this archetype of a leader which believes so deeply in their own ideas or their own thoughts that they're kind of willing to do anything to get there, and that we almost put that up on a pedestal. We seem to think we should be more like that at times. Can you just talk about that phenomenon as well?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose you could talk about whether inventors or true innovators or truly creative people are oblivious to the ideas of others, right? So the claim would have to be that individuals generally can come up with fantastic ideas on their own without input from others, and that they can't update and that they don't sort of adopt guidance, advice, you know, stimulation of other ideas from others. And there's a little bit of truth to that. Interestingly, there's a researcher at the University of Illinois, Jack Gonzalo, who talks about the most creative people being somewhat oblivious to social cues, meaning that they're willing to push their ideas and, you know, not be polite and not give in to the wishes of the group. And you know, as a result, are able to identify and push through some of the most creative ideas. That's a little bit true. What is less true is that most big ideas, really big ideas, you know, how are we going to solve climate change? How are we going to address health issues? You know, what, you know, how are we going to develop new technology that people will use? Most of that requires some sense that you're having a positive impact on the world. And it's, you know, narcissists aren't necessarily interested in that. They're willing to propose a grandiose vision that may sound like it has some socially redeeming aspects to it, but ultimately they're really just interested in developing their own wealth, developing their own power, being viewed as brilliant or creative or innovative. And that's why I hedge on Elon Musk, because some of his ideas are really things that I think he believes, you know, in his core are going to help humanity more generally. And that's not the typical profile of a narcissist. A narcissist would say something like, well, I don't want to quote those who we know to be narcissists, but, you know, I alone can solve this, comparing themselves to, you know, biblical figures. I mean, that's when we start getting into narcissistic territory.
Hmm. Makes me think more there of politicians. Yes. Do we see that behavior? Is it almost more common in the realm of politics than, say, Silicon Valley startups? Has anybody ever looked at that?
Yeah, we don't have the same kind of base rate information about politicians we should. And politicians are really tricky because think about how we label politics. We call it public service. Mm-hmm. And so right at the kind of initial phases, you could imagine that people enter into public service because they believe they can be of service to the public, right? Which is, you know, not supportive of a narcissistic narrative. But we do see that once people get power, they can begin to sort of go inward and start abusing that power and stop thinking really rationally about what's good for the population at large. We know that there is some way in which power corrupts people. There's research on this. Dacher Keltner here at UC Berkeley, where I am, has studied the ways that power can corrupt. It reduces people's impulse control. It causes people to dismiss others' preferences and, you know, to take more than their fair share. So there is potentially a story for politicians about becoming drunk with power rather than actually becoming a narcissist.
Mm, interesting. What does it say about us? I mean, just psychologically, that we or some of us are drawn to narcissists or the kind of messianic figure you see in politics or occasionally in business. Clearly there's something in us that is activated as well into wanting to buy into these types of people.
Yeah. So I'm a social psychologist by training, and I have to say that the issue stumps me, honestly, on kind of where we are in the US today on this issue is really perplexing. But it is true, you can go back to de Tocqueville, you know, an early philosopher who really said that people like the security and comfort that comes from being led and being sort of indoctrinated and told what to think and what to do. And that there's a kind of comfort and security in that. And, you know, you can kind of understand it at the current time where so many, you know, just gargantuan issues are in play. I mean, the climate issue alone, if you really took it seriously, would be incredibly scary and stressful. And so the idea that someone can come along and claim that they can, you know, maneuver through this and, you know, that they're stronger than anything, I think there's some appeal there. That said, you know, it can be incredibly destructive because if people stop thinking for themselves, they're not going to be vigilant about what leaders are offering to them or taking from them. And again, you know, this tendency for those who have power to become exploitative of others and to abuse that power is very, very high.
Are there any historical figures that you know, our listeners might be able to recognize that you would say fit the traits of a narcissist?
Well, probably Napoleon. You know, who many of the battles that he fought were almost personal vendettas, and you have a sense of someone who was very sensitive and, you know, thought of any challenges as personal affronts and, you know, reacted on that basis. I was just in Paris and looking at the size of the Louvre, which was Napoleon's home. I mean, it would take half a day to walk from one end to the other, you know, just sort of this grandiosity that is kind of hard to miss.
It just reminds me, though, of some of the political figures on our scene. I mean, whether it's Modi in India, who kind of remains in power, obviously Putin, other people. I mean, it seems like we're in this era where these political leaders are just clinging to this sense with maybe a bit of narcissism, but like these characters are arising around us in this world right now in a way that feels almost alarming. Would you agree?
Yeah, I worry about that. I mean, you could say Netanyahu and you know, who's gotten lots of feedback that people don't agree with a variety of his stances. You know, even before the war, there were issues and he kind of continued ahead regardless. I do worry about it. And again, I go back to the idea that I think the challenges that we're facing are at such an existential level, right? Particularly climate, that I think people are looking for leaders who claim to have the answers and who claim that they will, you know, maintain the status quo or in some cases even go back to an earlier, you know, less worrisome period. And I think people just find that appealing. The problem is it's an illusion. What we know about narcissistic leaders over the longer run, and this is not even that much longer, you know, after a couple of years, as CEOs, we've studied this empirically. We know that narcissistic leaders create organizations that have cultures that are less collaborative and less ethical. And both of those things threaten the survival of organizations. If organizations behave unethically, right, they could easily shorten their lifespan as a result of it. And if organizations are less collaborative, it's the whole reason you organize is you bring people together to do things that no single individual can do on their own. So if a narcissistic leader undermines collaboration, you're in real trouble.
Well, finally, just staying here with a culture that we live in. I mean, this is also the era of TikTok personalities and Instagram and reels and videos. And there is a certain cult of personality that is being developed around us and extolled. So, I mean, bringing in this question of narcissism, is there also just something in this kind of cultural soup that we live in that prizes the individual and the creator and the person who's willing to say anything and be authentic? Does that fit into this at all, or do you think it's kind of a this has happened at all eras?
Yeah, I think, you know, as a psychologist, we have long suffered with a bias called the fundamental attribution error, which means that we attribute individual causality to a person's behavior and successes. And we fail to look at the structural or environmental or contextual causes of their behavior. And we've always done that, right? That as human beings, we like to think that people are in control of their circumstances. And in fact, in many cases, people are a product of their circumstances and their structure, right? And that, you know, that emerges in so many different ways, you know, in terms of racial inequality as a structural constraint for, you know, mobility and that kind of thing. But we have always looked to individuals and assumed that they're large and in charge of everything that they do. So I think we continue to be fascinated with that. And TikTok is just kind of the latest vehicle by which we are celebrating that perspective.
Jennifer Chapman, thank you so much for the time. We appreciate it.
You bet.
And once again, that was Jennifer Chapman, professor of management at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business. And still to come, charismatic and charming, arrogant and manipulative. How do we spot and avoid a narcissist? We'll get to that after this short break. And a reminder that you can connect with me directly and ask me questions about this show. Give me your ideas. I'm on Instagram at Jonathan W. Bastian. You can also connect with the show on Facebook. There's a link to that at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. We'll be back with part two of our conversation on narcissism after this short break. Stay close.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
I'm Jonathan Bastian, back with Life Examined on KCRW. We just heard Jennifer Chapman, social psychologist and professor of management at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, talk about the appeal of a narcissistic leader and the phenomenon that many of us find comfort in being led and told what to do, regardless of the ways and means. So how do we better understand this type of narcissistic behavior? Are there some telltale signs to look for in a partner? And is a relationship with a narcissist doomed to fail? And how do we heal? And can a narcissist ever change? In her book, It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People, author and clinical psychologist Ramani Durvasula explains the clinical definition and shares why narcissism is having such a moment. Dr. Ramani, welcome to Life Examined.
Thank you so much for having me.
Give us a little background on narcissism as a term, as a diagnosis, because to me, it feels like a very ancient word, something that, you know, probably has roots way back when. But how do you understand its history?
So the word narcissism has an interesting history, right? If you really actually dig into historic, even Greek and Roman texts on how people would think about health and humors, there was some identification of people who were difficult or antagonistic. But really, this word narcissism percolating up into the psychological canon, that didn't really happen until probably when we started seeing folks like Havelock Ellis, Otto Rank, like early analytic writers. Mm. And then probably Freud was the first one that took this term narcissism and put it on a bigger stage. But it really became a term about, you know, sort of ego and defense mechanisms and all that, that kind of lingered in the psychoanalytic world. And then folks like Kohut and Kernberg in the 70s and 80s really brought this word up in terms of talking about things like pathological narcissism, and Kohut really talking about sort of the role of shame in narcissism and rage and all those other sorts of emotional dynamics. And then continue fast forwarding, we have people, folks like Keith Campbell at University of Georgia and Joshua Miller, people like this, Aaron Pincus, who started doing more and more research on it from the social personality side, folks like Elsa Roningstam at Harvard that really talked about it from the research side. But let me tell you what nobody was talking about on the scholarship or clinical theory side, what this did to other people. Mm. There would be sort of a passing note about, like, that's not very nice for other people. But I was thinking, why is this not its own area of inquiry? But as always, the narcissistic people get all the attention. There's actually now, I would say in the last 25 years, a much more robust, not only theoretical, but also clinical literature that's been flourishing around understanding sort of the dynamics of narcissism, and that it's not just grandiosity, but it takes it a lot more territory than that.
So let's break down exactly how we define narcissism as a clinical diagnosis. Like, what, mm-hmm. what are the basics we need to know about narcissistic personalities?
So let's keep two things separate here. Mm. There is that diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder that debuted in the DSM back in 1980. So pretty, I'm going to say recently, to be frank with you, what is that? It's only 44 years ago. And so that was, you know, so that's a diagnosis. I don't like that diagnosis, and I'll tell you why. It doesn't move the needle clinically. It doesn't give us a lot of information, and most clinicians don't employ it for a variety of reasons, including stigma, insurance companies don't like it, and everyone who's narcissistic comes into therapy with something else going on. So that usually that primary thing, whether it's a substance use disorder, whether it's a mood disorder, whether it's relational problems, those tend to take center stage. The narcissism often gets lost in the initial period of when we see a new client. But that said, there's narcissism, the personality style, and then there's a thing called narcissistic personality disorder. So I'm going to talk very briefly about narcissistic personality disorder so then we can kick it away out of the conversation because I think it muddies the waters. Narcissistic personality disorder is a personality disorder. So by definition, that means it's stable, persistent, pervasive, maladaptive, and rigid. So this person's behavior cuts across a lot of different situations governed by this personality style. And it's characterized by a chronic state of low or variable or shallow empathy, entitlement, grandiosity, arrogance, envying other people, thinking other people envy them, a tremendous self-centeredness, an excessive need for praise, validation, or admiration, being interpersonally exploitative, taking advantage of other people. That's narcissistic personality disorder. For a person to get that diagnosis, they have to have that pattern. They have to show up in a clinician's office. A clinician has to evaluate them. A clinician has to tender that diagnosis. There's a lot of people out in the world walking around with likely what meets criteria for this NPD, but they are never seen by a clinician. And there are people out there with NPD who have a lower severity of narcissism than folks that have never seen the inside of a clinician's office. So I think some people make the mistake of saying, oh, they have NPD, this must be so severe. I'm like, no, if they have NPD, it means they saw a clinician. I mean, that's all that tells me, or they were evaluated. I used to do research on this, so we would spend hours trying to come to this sort of diagnosis, but we typically didn't tell the individual because it didn't really change anything. Now, narcissism, that's an entirely different beast. That's a personality style. And if we really want to put it under its bigger umbrella, that bigger umbrella is antagonism. Narcissism is sort of a representation of that larger quality of antagonism, which takes in territory like hostility, manipulativeness, entitlement, arrogance, egocentricity, all of that. So that all that stuff comprises narcissism. And as a personality style, like any personality style, it can agree to greater or lesser degrees. So it's on a spectrum. At the mild side, we're seeing more of an emotional immaturity, a selfishness, a vanity, a slight impulsivity. Again, it's really, this is a person who remains forever as an overgrown adolescent or child. So even at the age of 55, they might be obsessed with their video games and aren't helping out a spouse or attending to a human relationship the way they should. It feels more annoying. It can be very frustrating, though, if you're counting on them for something. But at the severe end of narcissism, we're talking about a very malignant style that almost has shared top notes with psychopathy or what we call antisocial personality. And that can include things like not only all the stuff I said, but also much more severe manipulation, coercion, exploitativeness, things like isolation, menace, the induction of fear. Obviously, that's a very different experience and a very different presentation. But all of us have personalities. You have a personality. I have a personality. And those personalities, depends on what theory you're using, lots of pieces come together. Narcissism is a very oftentimes extroverted style. It is a very, again, it is a very impulsive style. It is a very disagreeable style. It's built up of these bricks. And everybody has a personality. Narcissistic person just happens to have a narcissistic personality. I have an introverted personality. It really depends. We all have one. And so when we talk about it as narcissism and not as a disorder, I think it opens up the conversation in a very different way, because I think a lot of people are getting lost in the weeds of, well, you can't diagnose someone and how do you know they have a diagnosis? I said, I don't know they have a diagnosis. They have consistent behavior and it's showing up as antagonistic. I'm willing to take the bet. So it's a different conversation.
So let's just make it even simpler here, if that's even possible. Like, if we're trying to spot narcissistic behavior in someone, give us just some classic traits and make it understandable for us. Like, what are we looking for here?
You're looking for somebody who is able to talk about themselves and things that interest them endlessly, but anytime the conversation shifts to something where it's not relevant to them or not interesting to them, they sort of tune out. We're looking at someone who chronically interrupts you during a conversation or even seems to hold a contemptuous gaze when someone else is talking and they're not interested in them. These are people who struggle with doing things like waiting in a line. If they feel like they're not special, they're not getting the best seat or the best, the best VIP treatment, they will get a little bit churlish and angry and they might act out and they might yell at people. And again, that's the entitlement showing up. These are also people who are very, 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 very sensitive to any form of feedback or criticism. So it might not even be that it's negative feedback. You might even tell them something that's actually kind of a compliment, but it's sort of based in reality. But because they're so grandiose, your simple piece of feedback can spin them out into a rage. However, while they can't take it, they can dish it out. And so they might give you a critique, but if you push back on it, they will gaslight you and call you, they will tell you that you're overly sensitive or being ridiculous. So there's a lot of hypocrisy there. But the other the problem is, as I'm giving you all of these sorts of problematic traits, like, again, also low frustration tolerance. If things don't go their way, they will get angry, they'll huff, they'll puff, they'll yell at the gate agent at the airport or the person pouring their coffee in a coffee shop or a person who's working for them. They will always snap, snap, snap. There's a lot of impulsivity and very little regard for how their behavior affects the other person. But a lot of this shows up as initially, not when the bad things are happening, but initially we can also see a lot of charm, charisma, confidence. These are people that can be very compelling. And so what confuses us is that the person we first met was actually, again, compelling and charming and charismatic. And then we see this other behavior, so it doesn't reconcile. And as a result, because the good stuff is often what we met first, we will often try to make excuses about these problem behaviors, but they are, in fact, problem behaviors. Mm.
I know this can be a difficult question to answer, because how is any personality formed, right? Is this the social structure they grow up in? Is it genetics, whatever? But where do you think a narcissistic personality comes from? Do we think it's embedded in their childhood? What's your thought on that?
So the narcissistic personality, I think like many personalities, it's very much a social developmental phenomenon. Mm. We're born with the biological temperament we have. And I think that's sort of, if you will, the kind of that what Marsha Linehan would call our biological vulnerability. Some people would say maybe that's as close as we come to the genetic part of personality. But it's that little, I always call it sort of the sourdough starter of personality that's passed across the generations, which is why you might have a little quirk that resembles an uncle that you never met or something like that. That temperament, though, comes up against an environment. And that environment consists of early childhood experiences, attachment to caregivers, the stability of the childhood environment, the validation, the attunement, the awareness of adults in the environment around the child, the soothing the child got, the sense of safety the child grew up with. And then as the child gets older, that's then shaped by even larger influences, extended family, schools, community, and all of that. But that's how personality shapes out. Now, when that early childhood environment is characterized by adversity or abuse or trauma, neglect, chaos, lack of attunement, disruptions in attachment, that's where we can start seeing the forming of these more maladaptive personality styles like narcissism. However, the vast majority of people who grow up under such conditions of adversity don't go on to become narcissistic. So it's still a developmental phenomenon that even with those conditions, not everyone is shaped out in that way. You do need that interaction between temperament and this sort of the social developmental context. And narcissism's a little bimodal. There's not only the adversity pathway, but there's also this other pathway where we see overvaluation, overindulgence, telling the child they're more special than any other child, that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's interesting because the first way you described it, say it was, you know, somewhat of a childhood in which the child felt abandoned or not seen, and that to me these traits are kind of almost a survival mechanism. It's a way of trying to kind of puff one's chest and say, look, I am worthy of respect. I should be taken seriously. Like that's, and to me, that's a very sad realization of how someone could become who they are. Does that true, do you think?
Oh, I absolutely think it's true. They do puff the chest, and it is look at how great I am. The challenge is, though, narcissistic people have the capacity to be very socially skilled and aware when the stakes are worth it to them. Mm-hmm. So they're on the golf course with the CEO and they're listening to them talk about their child and they're very seemingly empathic and attuned and paying attention. But after that golf game, that same person will go home and scream at their spouse. So they have that repertoire. They have that capacity to show up as an attuned, healthy human being. And they're able to keep it together when the stakes feel high enough to them. Yes, to your point, these are definitely defensive maneuvers. And I think the challenge then becomes, though, because these are often folks who are functioning pretty well in the world, in fact, quite well in the world, they have these two repertoires, one for the people for whom they really value their validation and praise and admiration, the other for people they're more dismissive around, maybe people they feel are more disposable.
Right.
Is when do we then expect the narcissistic person to take some responsibility for their behavior? Or do we all have to live in this situation where we have to act as sort of the punching bags for narcissistic people who can't get it together but seem to still be making more money than the rest of us?
One of my favorite descriptors of a narcissistic person, this was from one of my professors in school, was a narcissist either looks up or down at people. They're looking up right at the CEO to get where mm-hmm. they want to get, or they look at their spouse and be like, you're below me. You're not worthy mm-hmm. of my respect. Mm-hmm. Do you find mm-hmm. that's like a fair analysis of a narcissistic personality?
I absolutely do. I absolutely do. And I think that they need both of those types of people around them to kind of keep the equilibrium. Mm. And in the same breath, if they look up to that CEO and they can put on their best face with that CEO because they need the praise and admiration, they also deeply, deeply envy that CEO.
Right.
And as that anger and shame gurgles up after that golf game, they're going to go home to that spouse they look down at and take it out on them. But the challenging part here is, as much as we can understand all of these dynamics, right, and it's all very interesting to do this, at the end of the day, these are very, very resistant dynamics to change because it's quite rare for a narcissistic person to take responsibility. They tend to shift the blame on others. They tend to think their problems are all the fault of other people, that they're not getting their due, and they will very rarely engage in the hard work of therapy, leaving the people in these relationships saying, I do love this person, but as long as I'm in this relationship, I'm being emotionally abused. What am I supposed to do? I feel bad because I can see how they're puffing up their chest, but am I supposed to be the human sacrifice so this person can regulate and feel better about themselves for the rest of their lives?
Yeah. So to me, this brings up these big questions of how we label people in our lives as narcissistic, because you and I would both agree that psychological terms are thrown around so loosely.
Yes.
These days, you know, everybody's bipolar, everybody's narcissistic, everybody's whatever. And so no doubt there are a lot of people listening to this interview and thinking, wow, this kind of sounds a lot like my mom or my dad or my partner. So how would you explain to them whether or not, or how they can help get to the root of whether or not these people actually are narcissists? Like, this is something that needs to be addressed. Where do we begin that conversation?
I would say it actually doesn't matter whether or not you figure out if they're narcissistic. I think that's too high a burden to put on somebody who's in a close relationship with someone. I always tell people, I'm using this term because it gets awkward for me to say carrots, chicken broth, celery, salt, spices every time I want to talk about chicken soup, right? I just want to be able to say chicken soup. You know what I'm talking about. But I think that in your own life, you kind of have to break it down by ingredients and to say, like, these are the patterns that keep showing up. The invalidation, the shaming of need, the chronic selfishness, the one-sidedness, the lack of empathy, on and on the list goes, and understanding these shows up differently depending on the kind of relationship. If this is what's happening, many people say, you know what? Narcissism, it doesn't matter. I read your book, and now I understand that this is a pattern that hangs together. And above all else, this wasn't my fault. I was lacking, because that's what the narcissistic person communicates to the other person. Well, I'm doing this because of you. Like, if you'd only been better, this is basically, it's your fault that you're being abused, which to me is one of the most horrific things that someone could do to someone. So I tell folks, don't get lost in the weeds of trying to figure out if your mom or your boss or your partner or your child or your sister is narcissistic. Stay focused on, there's a series of patterns here. They have not changed, and connect them to how you feel, that you don't feel safe in your body, that you don't feel comfortable with this person, that you don't even like seeing them, and that you chronically feel like you're not enough. And many people in these relationships will say, it's funny you say that, because I actually have friendships and other relationships in my life where I do feel okay about myself. So people are able to start making that discernment. But sometimes these close relationships are very powerful. Parents, partners, these are significant relationships. So I agree with you. Way too many people are overusing this word. Part of it is how social media works, right? Right now, narcissism's the word of the moment. Let me tell you, when I started doing this work 20 years ago, it wasn't. But now it is, and you get more hits on your video, and people are more interested. So I agree that completely there's a danger in saying, oh, somebody came late to breakfast, they're a narcissist. I'm like, no, they came late to breakfast. Now, if every time for the last 20 times they've shown up late and they yelled at you and said it was your fault that they were late and that you're too demanding and too needy and they give you the whole thing, and I'm like, okay, maybe we're talking about a really problematic pattern. Mm-hmm. But when you notice these patterns, I also don't think it's the responsibility of somebody who's being emotionally abused to get someone else into therapy. The person who's being harmed is suffering enough. To turn them now into a referral base to get screamed at, it's not a thing. The narcissistic person often is functioning quite well in the world. And this is why I often tell folks that, what are they going to say to them? You need to get therapy because you're not nice to me. The narcissistic person's going to gaslight them and shut them down so fast, it's going to escalate the rage. So that's why I tell folks in these relationships, you need to get the help for yourself and then understand the limits of this relationship, the limits in the capacity of that narcissistic person or that person who's behaving badly or behaving in an invalidating, chronically invalidating manner, and start giving yourself permission to disengage and build up other sources of support. It's very painful. It brings up a lot of grief, but I think there's no way it is ever going to be fair or just to expect people who are being harmed to also be the tool with which that now they have to be the person who's responsible for setting, you know, guiding someone towards therapy, which is more likely than not going to end up them being more emotionally abused. I'm never going to send someone in that direction.
Maybe you can just spend a minute talking about how people really are negatively impacted by narcissists, or just share some empathy. I know you write a lot about that, and maybe it's not discussed enough, but like what do you think it feels like to be married to a narcissist or have grown up in a family in which that was your mother or father?
Oh, it is a psychologically being turned inside out in a way that stays with you for a lifetime. It feels like confusion, rumination, regret, anxiety, helplessness, hopelessness, powerlessness, hypervigilance, self-blame, self-doubt, isolation, problems with sleep, distraction to the point of almost being dissociated. It does a number on a person who now devalues themselves at an essential level, and it holds people back. It makes people feel as though they have no right to express how they feel, what they want, what they need, and who they are. Because when they've done it in these relationships, they have been chronically shamed, guilted, told they are selfish or greedy or ungrateful. So this shapes a psyche. And we, in the field of mental health, have done such a disservice to these clients by trying to teach them how to communicate with someone who keeps harming them psychologically. And so the harms of this are, they're plentiful, but when they're met by a therapist who holds space for them, and I'm not saying this is always the case. Sometimes you've got two narcissists in a relationship. That's a whole different conversation. But in a person who actually does have intact empathy, compassion, the capacity for reciprocity and mutuality of regard, when those people are pulled into these relationships and they get into therapy and they're given a framework and validation and told basically, and I know we're not supposed to use this word, it's a dirty word, but clients use this all the time, that they're not crazy, that goes a long way for these clients. And they start feeling like they're back in their bodies. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of grief. They're like, whoa, this is my parent. And I'll never have the relationship I wanted. Or, oh, I'm not sure what to do now because I've been married to this person for 20 years. It certainly opens up another can of worms. But what it does lift is a huge psychological burden that it's not you.
Yeah, no, that's really important. Back to just the social component here. Do you think we should extract ourselves from people who are narcissistic? Do you think the healthiest way out of a relationship that just feels very unhealthy with someone with those traits?
Well, I'm going to use a psychological word you know well. I say we should decathect ourselves, right? We don't have the luxury to walk away from all of these relationships. So what we've got to do is not invest ourselves emotionally. They're not, so why should we? So it might be that you're from a family where you like 75% of the people, but there's like three or four people you're like, yeah, no, if I never saw them again, it would be too soon. But they're part of a larger social fabric, and you're not going to be able to isolate them out because it might disrupt the status quo. But you might go to that family event and really say, I'm going to see this cousin, this aunt, and those grandparents, and I'm going to pull my chair up with them, and I'm going to see them, and I'm going to be very perfunctory in my relations with the others. The same could be said as a workplace or anywhere else. Now, in high contact relationships, I would say, for particularly like a partner, that doesn't work as well. But not everyone can leave a relationship for a whole bunch of reasons, having minor children, for financial reasons, cultural or religious reasons, or even still, like you still feel like you got some skin in the game. And so that's where we see the most hurt and wounding happen. And some people will say, listen, I'm a part of a group of friends. A couple of those friends are narcissistic. I'd never sit with them and talk about my problems. I expect very little of them. But when we go out for a night of fun, they're fun. And then I expect nothing from them. So we have to ratchet down our expectations, recognize they're never really going to show up in the way we need them to. So we need to stop showing up with our whole selves in that way and investing so much. So we need to decathect. But in some of these relationships, especially when it really leaves you chronically doubting yourself, being taken advantage of, they often, that you not only just have to disengage, but sometimes you need to completely leave.
Any tools for just managing relationships with narcissists? I really like that idea of kind of saying, I'm not going to bring emotional energy to this. I'm not going to expect mm-hmm. you to support mm-hmm. me emotionally. But just for people that are in daily contact with narcissists, ways to just be with them that is just more helpful, do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that it's, I always tell folks, I give them the acronym, don't go deep. Don't defend, don't engage, don't explain, and don't personalize. Don't get into the mud with them. If they start accusing you of something you didn't do, don't try to explain it away. You know you didn't do it, and they're just looking for the fight. So learn that kind of way of engaging. You know, when they're trying to gaslight you, you're just going to say, listen, I think we're seeing this differently. And they're going to say, no, we're not, and they're going to go on and on. In fact, in some ways, the most important tool for interacting in a healthy manner with a narcissistic person is to first do some of the much more difficult work of knowing yourself, knowing, you know, it really you saying, I have a reality and my reality is valid. I remember that correctly. I'm not going to be dismantled so easily, but that can often be long, long-term work, especially if it's been done to us since childhood. And the other piece I say, and this is actually a little bit more accessible, one of the big mistakes we make is we'll often share really good news we got with a narcissistic person too quickly, right? We'll go to them first. We'll say, I got to tell you this good thing. And you know what they'll do? They'll shut it down. They'll make fun of it. They'll minimize it. They'll feel competitive with it. They'll feel threatened with it. And by the time you're done telling them it, you'll actually feel sad and bad. Whereas had you told it to your healthy friends, they would have been, oh my gosh, we're so proud of you. This is great. So learn the order in which this news gets to them and never take it to the narcissistic person first. Same thing applies to bad news. If you have bad news, they might seem inconvenienced by it, bothered by it, tell you, you created this mess. What the heck are you expecting from me? Same thing. Take that bad news to people who can work with you collaboratively, help you solve the problem, who can be empathic, who can be supports, and then they'll find out about it down the line. That really only leaves you sticking to the neutral topics, sort of the superficial points of engagement, the weather, you know, who's doing well in March Madness, whatever it is that is not going to cause a fight. And people say, gosh, that seems so empty and inane. It always was empty and inane. Now you're just seeing it clearly. So, you know, you can avoid getting stuck in this by really disengaging, but you don't have to be cold. You don't have to be antagonistic. You can just really understand what the limits and capability there are in this relationship and on their side and just the limits of the relationship and stop trying to make it be something it's not.
And here's, I think, a very difficult question that someone does need to ask themselves, and maybe this requires going to therapy, is that, am I in a pattern of kind of falling back in love with narcissists, right? Because I think there is a type of person that is attracted to that and then probably wakes up again and says, oh my God, here I am with somebody who's not listening to me, who's gaslighting me, who's making me feel less than. And I think that's really important personal work that we all have to do, right?
Yeah, I don't think anybody's attracted to the dark side of narcissism.
No,
I think what people are attracted to is the charm, the charisma,
exactly,
the compelling attractiveness, right? I think where it gets tricky is who gets stuck. Mm. And then there are people who find that they repeatedly keep getting stuck in relationships where they feel like they need to fix, they need to be better, where they have to keep modifying, where they're often on their back foot. And that can often have origins in childhood, the parent where you're always having to pedal faster to get their notice. And we call these relationships with narcissistic folks trauma-bonded relationships because the intermittent alternation between good and bad often keeps people stuck in a cycle where they're justifying and making excuses and trying to figure out ways of fixing it, taking the blame on themselves and taking all the responsibility. Of course, the narcissistic person is also heaping responsibility on them. And so then they keep getting stuck and the sort of always having something to do in the relationship, and it can almost pathologically enliven it. And so, but people will also recognize intellectually, cognitively, left brainy, like this is not healthy. But the idea of leaving it fills a person with a sense of panic and discomfort. And so the work of therapy is often what people will do is, again, it's a sort of the mild dissociation. It's even this phenomenon that Dr. Jennifer Fried calls betrayal blindness, is this ability we have to cordon off the pieces of information that will impede our capacity to continue to remain attached to this person. And once we can have the lights turned on and all that betrayal stuff is actually kind of brought out of the closet into the middle of the room, you can no longer unsee it. And then you can sort of start doing that enjoining between what really happened and sort of those bodily and physiological sensations and the legacy issues, and then the sort of the really uncomfortable sort of stepping out of it. But this is why after a narcissistic relationship ends, it's very important that a person takes a very long break from intimate relationships and really does the work of the self, as well as the work of sort of taking back their subjectivity, their sense of self, their sense of who they are, rather than who they had to be to keep the narcissistic relationship going.
Well, finally, can a narcissist change? Can they evolve out of these character traits that we've been talking about?
Depends on what you mean by change, right? There's small C change and there's big C change. And small C change might be little bits of putting their phone down when they're talking to someone else, showing up on time, not screaming when someone asks them to empty the dishwasher. And that small C change for some folks could be enough. The big C change, well, that's a different beast, right? Big C change is the available empathy, the attunement, the ability to maintain sort of balance and equity in a relationship, the self-regulation, the self-awareness, the not blame shifting. I really haven't seen the big C happen that much. I've seen a lot of small C in my career. And with each individual in these relationships, it's on them. For some people, they'll say, you know what? I don't see this person this much. It's a sister of mine. The big C actually has been enough for me. I don't want to see her every day. I sure as heck don't want to spend hours with her, but that's enough. But for someone in a marriage, the small C stuff may not be enough. And you might be holding out for the big C, and that's a lot harder to get. That means a commitment by the narcissistic person in long-term therapy with a deeply, profoundly skilled therapist and the humble, humble willingness to take ownership of how they harmed other people and recognize that even if they make some of these big C changes, they may have burned these bridges. And to have to start anew with new people, and hopefully those big C changes persist. But the kind of access to therapy, commitment to the work, and humility, it's a bit of a unicorn. But small C stuff we see all the time.
It's been so fun to be joined by Dr. Ramani Durvasula, clinical psychologist and author of It's Not You, Identifying and Healing from Narcissistic People. Dr. Ramani, thanks for the conversation and the information. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, that's it for this week. The producer of our show is Andrea Brody, and we'd love to hear from you. Did you grow up with a narcissist? Do you have narcissists in your life? How have you learned to manage and cope with these different relationships? Chime in on our Facebook page. There's a link to that at kcrw.com/lifeexamined. There you can check out our archive of shows, and don't miss the Midweek Reset, which drops every Wednesday. I'm Jonathan Bastian. You can connect with me on Instagram @JonathanWBastian. Have a wonderful day. We'll see you soon.